I declare bankruptcy!
I congratulate you on your imagination, but this is a court of space law, not a theater.
Fax mentis incendium gloria culpum, etc., etc. Memo bis punitor delicatum. It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal.
How is this a fair trial? Our lawyer is a Morty.
It's not fair. You have no rights, and he's not a lawyer. We just keep him here because he's fun. Look at him go.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 145. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your other host, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am great. I am, one, super excited about our guest on the show. And number two, I'm excited that your cold appears to be markedly better than it was during 144. I think our audience is in for a treat.
Yes. Britt Hermes naturopathed me into being better, so... That's definitely what happened. There's a little teaser intro to our interview today with Britt Hermes. It's going to be a lot of fun. Excited to talk to her. Really interesting situation and story, by the way. Just her progression through naturopath to skeptic to activist. It's really interesting. So look forward to that as the main segment. And then, Andrew, we've got another exciting episode coming up that you wanted to tease a little bit.
Yeah. Next week, we are going to have Lucian Greaves on from the Satanic Temple to discuss the Satanic Temple's lawsuit against Missouri. A lot of you have wanted to know about this. The case is in the news. We initially discussed the Missouri law way back, I think, in 2016. I think that's how old this case is. And so we are going to the man himself, Lucian Greaves. He's going to be on next week.
Yeah, this is so funny because I'm going to the woman herself. I have on Serious Inquiries Only. Independently, Lydia set up an interview for me with someone from the Satanic Temple. So that's going to be interesting. We'll have to see if, maybe we can cover different ground on each, but, that's going to be the full experience. So I'm excited for both of those, or maybe I'll just cancel mine. We'll see how it goes. but one way or the other, you're going to know everything you ever could have possibly wanted to know about the Satanic Temple. And that's awesome too, because we always reference them as doing they're doing some awesome work regarding, you know, whatever legal, religious BS that the theocrats are doing. So it's going to be fun to finally actually talk to somebody, rather than just talking about them in the news.
Yeah, I'm excited.
All right. Well, with that said, let's get to our interview with Britt Hermes. And we are joined by Britt Hermes. We are very excited to talk to you. You've got into a little legal trouble recently, so so this is the place to discuss legal issues. But before we get to that, I'm wondering if you want to go a little bit into your background, about how you became a naturopathic doctor who then gave it up. Do you mind giving us the Reader's Digest version of your story?
Right. So I became a naturopath after I had a really bad experience with a medical doctor in high school. Essentially, I developed this really ugly skin condition called psoriasis, which is this inflammatory skin disorder where you get these big red patches of flaky, kind of ugly skin all over your body. And I had a pretty bad case of it. I went to the dermatologist who happened to be my mom's doctor. My mom has this condition as well. In my experience was the doctor was a bit of a jerk. I felt like he wrote me off, didn't really give me the emotional care that I needed. I certainly received medical care and appropriate medical care, but I was looking for more than that. And this sort of sparked an interest in looking into alternative remedies and natural medicine in general. Fast forward, you know, finishing high school and going to college, I'm looking for graduate schools. And in the midst of looking up health psychology programs, which was what I was really interested in, I found a graduate school promoting naturopathy, or naturopathic medicine is how it's commonly referred to by people who are proponents of this particular branch of alternative medicine. So I attended a school named Bastyr. Bastyr is accredited in North America, but the accrediting board is run by naturopaths and people who are, you know, sympathizers to alternative medicine. I graduated from Bastyr in 2011, and then I practiced for about 3 years. And it was while I was in practice in Tucson, Arizona, that I became disillusioned with naturopathy. My former boss, who is still practicing today, treats cancer patients with alternative therapies like intravenous vitamin C and other herbs and nutrients and various supplements. We were, at the time in 2014, treating patients with a drug called Ukraine, like the country.
Okay.
And one day, the drug didn't arrive in the mail. Now, what was interesting about this particular so-called herbal medicine is that it would arrive in the mail. So typically, the alternative treatments that we use, you could get from compounding pharmacies or places from within the United States. But Ukraine was arriving from Austria, and patients had to pay for it in cash up front in order to get the medication. So when the package of the Ukraine didn't arrive for the next round of treatments, patients were very concerned because they had paid thousands of dollars for it and, you know, were waiting for their precious cancer medication. I asked my boss what was up with this. You know, why would the medication not arrive? Patients aren't worried, yada, yada. And he made the comment that the FDA had probably confiscated the package of Ukraine. Now, I thought that was an odd thing to say.
Yeah, that's good. That should set off some red flags.
It definitely made alarm bells ring. And it was a Friday, funny enough. And I came home from work that day and I said to my husband, so my boss said this funny thing about this medication being confiscated by the FDA. And it took a weekend of Googling to kind of figure out what that meant, because this is what makes naturopathy, I think, so unique and confusing.
So why was it confiscated?
Why was it? Yeah. Okay. So let me get to the crux of the story. So it was confiscated probably by the FDA for two reasons. One, Ukraine is not approved by the FDA to treat cancer or any other disease. The other thing is that the manufacturer of Ukraine, who was in Austria at the time, had just been arrested for fraud related to charges for relabeling expired products and continuing to sell and to export it to countries like the United States. So it's possible that whatever didn't show up in the mail that day, you know, came from an expired lot of medication. So to import...
The reason that I wanted to add that, yeah, this is really surprising to me is because most of that stuff is covered. There's an offshoot of the 1990 Nutrition Labeling Education Act. The offshoot was passed in 94. It was a brainchild of Jesse Helms. No, I'm sorry. It was a brainchild of Orrin Hatch, the senator from Utah, who there's a really big supplement industry out in Utah. And essentially, this is oversimplifying, but things that carry that disclaimer, right? This product has not been evaluated by the FDA and is not approved to diagnose, treat any disease. You know what, you've seen the standard disclaimer. That's a get out of jail free card, right? It means the FDA doesn't touch it. And so they don't care because, you know, think about it. A lot applies to, you know, homeopathics, right? Which is,
yeah, I usually think of this kind of stuff as like, you know, when they say like, that's not even wrong about a statement, like it's not even coherent enough to be wrong. I usually think of it as like, it's not even medicine enough to be bad medicine. It's just like kind of nothing.
It's nothingness. Well, what's interesting about Ukraine is that the manufacturer of this this so-called drug, had applied for FDA approval and was denied. And he also applied for, you know, similar approval in other countries like Australia, the UK, most of westernized Europe, for example, and was basically denied everywhere. It is approved in a few countries, but these countries, you know, are like Kazakhstan and other countries that aren't necessarily known for having, you know, really strict medical standards. But, you know, the major countries, the US, Canada, UK, I think Australia, had all denied approval of this drug. And previously, I don't remember exactly the time frame, but many years before this, there was a medical doctor in the United States who was importing and administering Ukraine, was caught by his medical board in whichever state he was. I don't recall now. I think it was perhaps Georgia. Interested listeners can look up the case. And he was severely reprimanded by the medical board, severely reprimanded with, I think, at least minimal, like a substantial fine. And he perhaps even had his license revoked or suspended for some time. And so I'm sitting at home over the weekend and I'm finding all of this information. You know, I'm finding denied approvals for FDA clearance. I'm finding, you know, stories and information about the drug trying to go through approval process in other countries. And I'm finding this medical case. And then I'm realizing in sort of this like slow motion way that importing and administering a non-FDA approved drug like this is a federal crime, actually.
Wow.
And that scared the bejesus out of me.
And this was really the first kind of warning sign for you was the your research into the Ukraine drug?
Yeah, it was really the wake up call. You know, now that I'm out of the cult of naturopathy, I can sort of see things differently. You know, I can look back on other experiences and be like, yeah, that was a little weird. And yeah, maybe I was a little more skeptical than most of my colleagues. But nothing had made me look at the profession with a new set of eyes like this did. You know, nothing had sort of forced me to take a step back from my profession and think like, whoa, what is going on here? Do I want to be a part of this? Can I really continue to call myself a naturopath when I know that a substantial portion of the naturopathic community is doing things like this? Not necessarily committing federal crimes, but knowingly using medication that has not been proven or perhaps has been proven to not work, or is knowingly using other non-FDA approved medications when there are real medications that should be used.
Yeah. Right. So, but how did you deal with the fact that, like, this is pretty existential? I mean, there are a lot of people we've heard of who, like in the, you know, clergy or something, where they actually aren't even believers anymore, but it's their job and they need their job. How did you balance all those concerns?
Well, immediately, it was pretty clear because my super awesome lawyer, who I obtained as quickly as possible by showing up in his office Monday morning in tears, begging him to take me on as a patient or as a client, made it very clear for me. He just said, "Britt, you're on notice."
Okay.
So now that you know that this bad thing is going on, you're ethically and legally obligated to act, which includes quitting your job, which I had wanted to do anyway by that point, reporting your boss to the naturopathic board in Arizona. And I also went to the office of the attorney general and had a chat with an investigator there, which was totally terrifying. So navigating like the fallout of it and the immediate circumstances was pretty easy.
Yeah, it was pretty forced. The bigger on problem, you there. It wasn't like you could just kind of go along with it anymore.
Right. But what you touched on was like the bigger existential crisis of it. Like, you know, do I continue to be a naturopath, you know, go into practice for myself or work for another naturopath, or do I leave the profession?
Yeah, I mean, you've got a lot invested in it, obviously. I mean, education, it must have been a very difficult thing to try to think about throwing all that away. And by the way, after not that much time, right? You hadn't been in it that long.
No, I had been practicing for about 3 years at that point. Yeah.
So what was your thought process for the decision that you made?
Yeah. So I was unemployed suddenly. So I had time on my hands and I wasn't eager to jump into a new business venture. And so I used that time to really look at the profession critically. I got a psychologist and a psychiatrist on board, actually, to help me process what was going on and to help me contextualize what had happened and frame it. You know, I really needed some professional help outside of legal counsel to understand the biomedical ethical implications of what I had witnessed. And I was, I guess, open to receiving critical information about naturopathy that I had never, in a way that I had never been before.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, one of the things that struck me, I mean, when I have seen presentations or, you know, talk to people who have been involved with, you know, what you might kind of loosely put under the rubric of alternative medicine, that there tends to be a conspiracy theory element to it, right? I mean, big pharma is poisoning you or whatever. And at acts, I've seen it act in a lot of those other cases as, you know, kind of a defense mechanism, right? Like, well, of course this miracle cure was rejected by the FDA because the FDA is in cahoots with Merck and Big Pharma, and they're trying to make sure, you know, we suppress this, you know, cure that otherwise is going to be a miracle and is going to bankrupt these huge companies. Was that never kind of an issue for you, or was it just all of a sudden now there was a lot of cognitive dissonance, or I don't, you know, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. It's a good question. There's a bit of both. I mean, the overlap between people who believe in naturopathy and people who believe in conspiracy theories is huge. It's massive. Mm-hmm. So I definitely went to school with people who were 9/11 deniers, for example, you know, believed that vaccines were made with dead baby parts and
that's just
poisoned patients. God, that's scary that people believe that. There was a time in my undergraduate days when I questioned the safety and the efficacy of vaccines, but I never totally bought into the larger conspiracy theory of it. Mm. And I'm lucky that way, actually, because I think if I did believe in conspiracy theories, especially the ones about, you know, the FDA suppressing cures for diseases like cancer and, you know, poisoning the population with vaccines, I think it would have been much harder for me to leave. But it was just really hard for me to buy into conspiracy theories because I could never really get over the fact that, you know, if these conspiracy theories were true, the sheer number of people who would have to go along with hiding the information just never made sense to me. I mean, we can't even keep a secret in my family. I couldn't imagine, you know, millions of government workers, you know, hiding this type of information. Yep. It just didn't seem plausible to me. So I was lucky that way. I think if I had really bought into the big pharma conspiracies, I would have had a much harder time getting out.
Yeah,
absolutely. So should we fast forward to the legal problems you find yourself with right now? What is going on? Because I'm seeing, and I don't know if Andrew wants to start or maybe you should start, but I'm seeing that someone in the U.S. is suing you in Germany for saying something.
That's right. Yeah, I can give a brief summary, and then I would, of course, love to hear Andrew give some legal opinions or legal jargon around this. So I leave the profession. I leave Arizona. My boyfriend, who becomes my husband, so we get engaged during this time. He gets a position for a PhD in Germany. We move to Northern Germany. I decide to start a master's of science program. I have some extra time on my hands. I decide to start blogging, basically, is how that goes. So in February 2015, I start writing about my experiences as a naturopathic student and my 3 years in practice as a so-called doctor. And I thought that this was a really nice way for me to try to, first of all, understand what happened to me. I felt like I had, in a way, been brainwashed and misled by the naturopathic schools and the profession in general. And I was also in a unique position in that I had really just recently, fairly recently, graduated from naturopathic school. I still had all of my course documents and syllabi and pretty vivid memories of what my experiences were like during my time at Bastyr. So I thought that it was a sort of a key time to speak out, to share those experiences, and perhaps prevent patients from making the mistake of seeking naturopathic care, and also prevent students from falling into the trappings of the naturopathic marketing, which can lead one to believe that they're receiving a real medical education. So I'm writing, I'm talking about all of this. And in December 2016, I write about an American naturopath named Colleen Huber, who works in Arizona. She's licensed in Arizona, and she runs a clinic called Nature Works Best Cancer Clinic. She uses naturopathic treatments for her cancer patients. Some of the treatments that she uses include intravenous baking soda, high doses of intravenous vitamin C. She strongly promotes a sugar-free diet for all of her cancer patients. And she recommends that patients start her treatments before using chemotherapy or radiation. She has said things like chemo and radiation strengthen cancer and weaken patients. Yeah, it gets a little bit worse, actually.
Good.
She also considers herself to be a cancer researcher. She doesn't have a PhD. She doesn't have a medical degree. She only has her naturopathic degree. And yet she considers herself qualified to conduct cancer research on her cancer patients that come to her clinic. And she's been publishing data from these patients that visit her on a regular basis, I think for at least the last 4 or 5 years. So she started gathering data on her patients in 2006, and she has been publishing some iteration of her studies at least since 2014, maybe even a little bit sooner than that. And based on the information that she gathers in her clinic, she makes some pretty amazing claims about the power of naturopathy. You know, she has said things like, I think like 83% of the patients who follow our treatments. Oh, here it is. 80% of patients who complete our treatments alone go into remission. 85% of patients who complete our treatments and follow our food plan, which is the sugar-free diet, go into remission. And 93% of all patients in stage one through early stage four who do all of our protocols have gone into remission.
Wow.
Now that's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, what is the baseline for spontaneous remission in those cases? Do you know? I mean, how?
That's a really good question. I don't know, because she's lumping all cancers of all stages together.
Got it.
Oh, right.
Which oncology researchers don't do.
Yeah. Right. Because there's no such thing as cancer. It is a variety of different cancers. And of course you wouldn't. So anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's a good question. That's a good question. Yeah. I don't
would
know.
Be,
what
would it be fair to say, though?
Yeah.
That those numbers are an order of magnitude higher than you would expect. Right. That it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, those are, if those results are true, those are like world changing.
Yeah.
Results.
I was going to say, like, it's weird that people want to keep this like under wraps. Wouldn't we just be like, oh, someone cured cancer. Awesome. We don't have to do all this bullshit anymore. Like, we can just have a cure for cancer.
Yeah.
But I love that. It's so mind blowing to me, the conspiracy mindset that like all these people who, by the way, have family members and know people with cancer and all that. Like, they don't care. They want to hide the cure for cancer. And they wouldn't just immediately recognize it if it were scientifically valid.
Well, let's step out of the court case for a second and just, like, imagine being a cancer patient, you know, being told that you have, you know, cancer X, here are your treatment options, and then stumbling across a website that says chemotherapy and radiation will make the cancer stronger, make you sicker, and by the way, you have about a 90% chance of having your cancer cured regardless of what it is.
Through early stage four.
Using our natural therapy. Yeah. Oh,
gosh.
And without side effects. No side effects is the other claim on about these therapies.
Why don't they just sell immortality? I mean, it's about the same amount of ridiculous claim. If people are in a very vulnerable state, they're going to be, it's really cruel to promise that kind of thing.
I agree. I think cancer patients are vulnerable, and I think that they need extra protections. I'm particularly sensitive about cancer patients being taken advantage of, especially in Arizona, because of my own personal experiences of accidentally being involved with a practitioner who was, in my opinion, taking advantage of cancer patients and profiting off of cancer patients. And I sat with these patients and helped administer these injections of Ukraine. So to read something like this really just struck a sensitive nerve for me. And so I wrote about it. And as a budding biomedical scientist, you know, I'm in a PhD program now in Kiel, I heavily criticized these claims. And I looked at her research, which she self-publishes, so I was able to read the entire study, and I made some critiques about the methodology, and I brought up concerns about the ethics of her studies. You know, I was concerned that she never mentioned in the study that I read that she had received informed consent from the patients, for example. I was concerned about whether or not there was proper IRB approval on board for the study. I was wondering if the patients had actually, you know, were given true informed consent about these alternative therapies. And so I laid this all out there. And many months later, in August of 2017, Colleen Huber sent me a cease and desist letter from a German law, written by a German law firm. So she had gotten German legal counsel. The cease and desist letter basically demanded that I remove this blog post. I got my my German lawyer to read it, and you know, we talked about it. I haven't done anything wrong. My opinions laid out in the blog post are just that. They're my opinions. And so we didn't comply with the cease and desist, meaning I just left the blog post up. About a month after receiving the cease and desist, I was notified that I was being sued here in Kiel by this American naturopath. And so that's more or less where we stand today. You know, there's been a couple filings with the court, but we are expecting the court or the case to go to trial sometime between May and August of this year.
Yeah. And that was how I first came to know about what you were doing. I should add Britt's blog is naturopathicdiaries.com. It is super fascinating. I mean, I got kind of sucked down the rabbit hole. Like I went to the top post and I was reading the, should I go to naturopathic school? Right. Cause I get the, should I go to law school all the time? And I love that you're like, my answer to this is always, no. Well, actually I want to scream no. And you go through your experience. It's a great blog. I really enjoy it. But I heard about this through our mutual friend, Aran Segev with Australian Skeptics, who has organized a campaign to help raise money to pay for your legal costs, which we're going to link to that in the show notes. And you know, really, I thought this was a good time to kind of jump off a little bit and talk about the differences. I mean, this is between German libel and slander law and American defamation law. This is a real issue anywhere. In the United States, you know, we've talked about what the standards are to prove defamation and whether you happen to be in a jurisdiction that has robust anti-slap laws, right? Because that's clearly what this is, right? This is a strategic lawsuit against public participation. It is designed to take down something that is critical of an issue that people ought to be discussing in public, right? And that's,
yeah.
I mean, that's the point of your blog. As you point out on your should I go to naturopathics? Right? Like, you have people who are naturopaths who read your site and who, you know, are capable of, you know, processing the information you offer. And, you know, I imagine that not everybody who goes to your site comes away with 100% agreement on what you post. But that's right. That's what public discussion and debate is meant to be about.
Of course.
And,
yeah.
And this clearly seems designed to tackle that. Our tagline on the show is don't take legal advice from a podcast. Please don't take German legal advice from me because I have, right? But I pulled up that, all of that being said, I pulled up the German criminal code and their section on libel and slander. And
yeah, it's scary.
And so I want to read a couple of these because, you know, it's again, I'd have to delve into German case law to try and figure out how it's interpreted. And my German is, you know, not even at the where is the library level. But there's a translation online of the code, at least. Section 185 is, and I'm not making this up, it is entitled insult. And it says, an insult shall be punished with imprisonment not exceeding 1 year, or a fine, if the insult is committed by means of an assault, with imprisonment not exceeding 2 years, or a fine. That's a kind of an amazing
It's scary.
Law. And despite, you know, where I immediately went, section 192 is entitled insult despite proof of truth. And says proof of truth of the asserted or disseminated facts shall not exclude punishment under section 185 if the insult results from the form of the assertion or the dissemination or the circumstances under which it was made. So again, you know, I interpret that as in the United States, truth is always a defense to defamation claims. And this seems to say, you know, if you've phrased your opinion in a way that is insulting, even if it's true, that could still be actionable under German law. That on the face of it, that seems kind of preposterous. Right? Like, that can't be right.
Are we going to find out this is like those laws that are still exist in states where, like, you know, atheists can't drive or some bullshit that they don't actually enforce anymore? Or, I mean, because that sounds incredible. People can't insult each other in Germany?
Well, it is pretty incredible. I think if I understood part of the law correctly, I think it even goes so far to say that you like can't insult someone on the street. So if like someone cuts you off and you flip that person off in the car or yell out that you think that they are an a-hole, that technically a lawsuit could be brought against you. It's crazy. It's crazy to think that defamation is a criminal offense, that libel is a criminal offense here. Now, my German lawyer assures me that I'm not at risk of going
to jail.
Yeah, there must
be some further explanation.
And that this is a very antiquated, as you said, antiquated aspect of the law. Something that I think would be super awesome is if my court case could somehow update to modernize the German libel law to at least remove the criminal offense aspect of this, or to somehow modernize it so it doesn't sound so ridiculous.
Yeah, Germans need to start insulting each other like Americans do, like good, healthy American insults.
it's a bit crazy. I agree.
Well, you know, and one area where I wanted to drill down a little bit is you, in the article that discusses the cease and desist letter, you mention your lawyer's opinion that opinions are protected in Germany, which, you know, is again, that's also true here in the United States. And when I look at the particular statute, here's how it's phrased, right? It says, this is 186, it says defamation. It says, whoever asserts or disseminates a fact related to another person which may defame him or negatively affect public opinion about him shall, unless this fact can be proven to be true, be liable for imprisonment not exceeding 1 year or a fine or, you know, blah, 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 blah. So in other words, what I cue in on that is the offense is defined as a fact. The burden shifts to the person who has promulgated the statement to prove that the fact is true, which, you know, obviously that shifts the burden quite a bit, particularly when you're talking about someone who, you know, in the United States, I think it's very clear in the naturopathic world that this Colleen Huber would be considered a limited purpose public figure, right? Like she's
I was going to ask that just to clarify. Like if we were talking about U.S. law, there's no chance any of this.
This is Bat Boy territory, right? Like this is, you know, you would have to prove the New York Times v. Sullivan standard, and you would have to show that that Britt's statements were made with either knowing falsity or reckless disregard of the truth, right? And
So either like I didn't try to figure it out, or I knowingly and intentionally said something.
Right.
False.
And reckless disregard is even stronger than it, right? Like you can just be lazy and repeat something and that doesn't rise to the level. And the reason we, you know, we always make this is Bat Boy territory, right? Because, you know, you think about the National Enquirer or whatever that puts out, you know, Hillary Clinton gives birth to Bat Boy or whatever. Right. And the reason, right. Exactly. The reason those things are out there is because it does not make sense to try and sue the National Enquirer for defamation, because they're just going to say, oh yeah, look, like it's probably not true that Hillary Clinton gave birth to Bat Boy, but you know, here's what we did to validate our sources, you know, of cranks,
right?
And that's enough, right? So you know, we tell people one of the ways that you can conceive of is your defamation suit against a public official likely to succeed is, you know, is it worse than Bat Boy?
And right.
Yeah.
Or are they a private person, by the
right.
way? That's
yes.
another thing.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
if
absolutely.
It's just your neighbor, then it's a totally different standard. But I got a couple questions. It sounded like you were already resigned to it being a trial. Like it's going to go, there's no hope of settlement or mediation or whatever. And then secondly,
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then secondly, can we turn this into the Scopes monkey trial, but for naturopathy in Germany? Like that would be, can we put the whole,
the monkey trial. Yeah. I love this. I love
can
this
we,
story.
Can we put
oh my God.
This, this whole field on trial? That would be nice.
That, yeah, that's the story of agency, right? Like, did the monkey who took the photograph have agency? Is that,
well, the Scopes monkey trial is just whether or not they could teach evolution in school. And it's like,
oh, okay. Different game.
Yeah, different monkey. Different there's game. Like, there's a lot of monkey law. This is, yeah.
Brett and I are actually going to do, really we are going to do a spinoff podcast called Monkey Law. So
yeah.
Monkey Law.
Oh, wait, you were saying the selfie one, huh?
Yeah.
Is that,
that is
also one. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if that's related, but at any rate, can we put the entire field on trial here? That would be nice.
Well, okay. So here's what I know. And also what I don't know. So about your first point of being resigned to go to trial. So that's my assumption. Now, this is based on just my understanding of how the German legal system works, which really is limited to my own legal problems in Germany. So after Huber filed her lawsuit in Kiel, where I live, my lawyer filed a motion asking the court to require her to put down a deposit of a substantial amount of money with the court. So there's a law in Germany where whoever loses the court case in these types of situations has to pay some portion of the other person's fees. So if Huber loses, she has to pay some portion of my legal fees. If I lose, I have to pay some portion of her legal fees. And so he put in, you know, some paperwork with the court asking her to put down a substantial amount of money just in case she loses. And we won that argument. And so she had to put down a large sum of money. So she's already invested a lot into this case.
Yeah, I guess side question, is this a person of great means? I mean, is she somebody who's made a lot on this and therefore can kind of
I think so. I mean, I don't actually know what she makes off of these patients, but I've read things on Yelp and, you know, other types of these, you know, Rate My Doctor websites that suggest that she makes a lot of money and that there's a long waiting list to get seen at her clinic. So I'm under the impression that she has a lot of financial resources and is willing to spend tens of thousands of dollars to to take me to court. So it was my understanding that if she wanted to pull out of this court case, that would have been the time where she could have easily have said, no, I actually don't want to put down this massive deposit with the German court system and I'll just drop the case. But now that the money's there, it seems likely that she will take it all the way to trial. At least that's my lawyer's interpretation of her behavior. And things move a bit faster here in Germany than they do in the US. So I think going to trial sometime between May to August, it seems a bit quicker than like similar cases in the US that I've followed a little bit.
Yeah, Secondly, that's a lot quicker for a lawsuit filed in the fall of 2017. Yeah. So yeah.
yeah. You know, and then like putting the whole profession on trial. I mean, of course, that isn't going to happen in Germany. It doesn't make sense to happen in Germany. I think it would be interesting to
I don't know, because if it goes into what can you demonstrate the truth of what you're saying, then wouldn't it a little bit? You'd have to go into like, well, what is the science? What are the claims being made? Right?
Yeah. That's interesting. I don't know actually how that will go.
So my question, and it would not. You know, if this is a question to which you don't know the answer because it's law geekery, then, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. But I'm curious, the lawsuit is filed against you in Germany because that's where you're living and that's the court that has personal jurisdiction over you. But typically, right. Even a court of foreign jurisdiction will then have to face what we call a choice of laws question, right? And so a German court could nevertheless apply U.S. law if, for example, you could demonstrate that, and I'm reasoning backwards from how American courts work. So I may be 100% wrong about German courts, but so maybe I should say it on the other side. American courts often will have jurisdiction over an American citizen who is being sued by another American, but the gravamen of the case took place in Germany. And so the court will then apply German law, even though it's sitting in the mm-hmm. United States. So, you know, our first half of this, we were sort of talking about the differences between German and US law, but it strikes me, not the least of which is because your webpage is in English, that you may not have a lot of German listeners, right? The German law may not apply to you. You may be able to avail yourself of heightened standards. Has that issue come up? Do you know about that? Or
so my lawyer and I haven't talked about it explicitly, but we've sort of danced around it. Now, like, I know that certain claims were made in the lawsuit, like I wrote in English to inflict the greatest amount of harm, for example, was one allegation. When in reality, like, I wrote in English because I speak English and I'm not capable of writing in another language, German, Spanish, or anything else. And the other like piece of it, which I don't think really directly gets at your point, but perhaps touches on it, is, you know, I think it's at least my understanding that Huber has to show that she was harmed by my writing. And I think she has to show that harm occurred in Germany.
Mm.
Right. And so not necessarily Kiel or the state that Kiel is in, but perhaps all of Germany. Perhaps the German court could look at harm or be willing to look at a, you know, argument that harm was caused outside of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps this is what you're getting at with, you know, applying U.S. law, or at least, you know, some aspect of U.S. law. But I don't think that will be the case. That's not my understanding. Perhaps it's possible. I don't know. Yeah, I wish I understood all of this minutia of the German law, but it's quite complicated, and I'm trying to keep lawyer fees at a minimum. Actually,
that's a good strategy. So we endorse that one here.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to sit with my lawyer and have like a really lengthy conversation about all the ins and outs of all of these different details. But I also don't want to be charged 10 hours for it. So.
Yeah, no, we're like that, and so but we need to find the German equivalent of opening arguments so that you can listen to that. And,
yeah,
yeah, it's been quite the cultural experience, actually, getting sued in Germany and learning about this whole other aspect of German life that, of course, I had some familiarity with in terms of knowing, you know, what was allowed in terms of statements of opinion, but it's a whole different thing to actually find yourself involved, you know, embroiled yeah. in a German legal court.
Well, I'm sorry you have to learn about it from the inside. That's a
well, final question, Andrew, are we going to end up in German court because of this episode?
No German court will have jurisdiction over you and I, Thomas. So we're in good shape.
Yeah, you're damn right. We get over, yeah. We're an American show. We're only on the American internet.
Yep, that's right.
Only on the American internet.
BaldEagle.us.org.
Hey, you ask our president, and I think he'll back us up yeah. on that. So.
Well, Britt, where do things stand? I mean, a lot of people were able to raise a lot of money to help out. Do you want to talk about just in closing here where things sit? And anything
yeah,
else?
Yeah, sure.
This?
Yeah, so the science and skeptic community totally kicked butt. They stepped up in a big, big, big way. So this legal defense fund that was organized through Iran Segev, who's the president of Australian Skeptics, was incredible. And in about 8 days, we raised over 50,000 euros, which I think was close to... I forget what the exact conversion is, but like 80,000 Australian dollars. So a massive amount of money. The legal expenses in Germany are far less than that in the US. And so this sum is fully expected to cover my legal fees, which is incredible. And it's highly unlikely that I'm going to have to be out of pocket for any of this, which is, I can't even actually believe those words that I get to say that out loud. It's unbelievable how supportive the science and skeptic community has been. Now, extra funds that have been raised will either get donated to an international charity called Sense About Science that has been involved in libel reform in the UK, for example, and does a really good job about ensuring transparency of science. Or, and this is starting to be more likely the case, these extra funds will get parlayed into a general skeptics legal defense fund so that other, you know, bloggers like myself, who are of meager financial means, if they find themselves in a similar situation, they could apply to use these legal funds so that they can defend themselves and basically not be bullied and, you know, have to take blog posts down because of legal thuggery.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's
so
incredible.
I guess, Andrew, if we do end up in German court, maybe we'll be able to tap into that skeptic defense.
There
fund,
we go.
So that's good. Excellent. Well, yeah, thanks for so much for taking us through the story. That's incredible. I really hope that there can be a good resolution to this. And, you know, I'm glad that you're not backing down. I would hope that the other person would back down. But it looks like I agree with the logic that if they put down the money that they were required to put down, they probably aren't. So it's good that the community backed you up, and wish nothing but legal success for you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, where should we send anybody who wants to learn more about you and your blog?
Yeah. So people can learn all about me and more at my blog at naturopathicdiaries.com. The last several posts deal directly with this court case and the legal defense fund that was set up on my behalf. But also, if people peruse further back in time on my blog, they'll find all sorts of information about more details about my story, leaving naturopathy. The blog posts from the early days are pretty emotional and raw, and then they evolve into just exploring the science and the evidence behind naturopathy. So it's I even have a legislative guide on my website. So everything you could ever want to know about naturopathic medicine can be found on my blog, naturopathicdiaries.com.
Excellent.
Britt
Hermes, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on
the show. Thank you, guys. I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Okay, Andrew, we've got a Lydia S. question. Those are always my favorite. What's going on with this question? It seems to be a tweet of somebody else.
Yeah. This made the rounds. The Twitter handle is EagleWoman4, and it's a woman named CJ Backen, who writes, "As a Native American, I just had an epiphany about undocumented DACA people. How big of a coronary would Trump and Ryan have if the tribes welcomed the DACA folk onto the reservations, affording them protection under the sovereignty of the tribes?" And listener Lydia S., who apparently has some pull around here, sent me a question and said, "Hey, is this real? Is this a possibility?"
Well, I can't wait till we get listener opening argument Smith questions. That would be good. I mean, it's in her name, so I guess. It's in her destiny.
I can't wait.
Hopefully, when she's like three, they'll just be nonsense, and I'll have to make you answer like nonsense questions.
That will be spectacular. I'm just thinking back. Those are great years, and I'm just thinking back to some of the amazing nonsense questions that Alex used to ask when he was three, right? You know, so like, you know,
listener opening argument.
How much
Smith's
does green weigh? Yeah.
Listener opening argument Smith asks, why? I'll just do that over and over for you. All right, but anyway, our actual question. This is interesting. Right. We've talked a little bit about sovereignty from like Native American reservation, that kind of thing before. So yeah, this sounds plausible to me.
Yeah, it should, because when you think of the word sovereign, you think of a separate nation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Native American tribes have been called a nation within a nation. But the reality is that they enjoy far less than you would think of as sovereignty than, for example, any country, right, including the Vatican. So a couple of things that are at issue here. The biggest, and it's kind of surprising to me that this is still one of the guiding principles of American-Indian law, which is how I was taught and how it is referred to in the legal field, is the notion, and you can immediately see this dates back to early 19th century cases, that the U.S. government has a special relationship and a paternalistic duty to protect Native American tribes. And that duty to protect language is found in the earliest cases in the 1820s. It is very much out of manifest destiny, white man's burden, we are taking care of our little brown brothers. I hope everyone knows I am using that terminology historically, referentially, and obviously I don't endorse it. What that means is that unlike other nations where the right of self-governance comes from generally accepted principles of international law that, you know, sovereign nations have a right to govern themselves, Indian sovereign nations do not enjoy that same level of sovereignty on their own reservations, not with respect to their own citizens, and certainly not with respect to non-members. So in other words, the law enforcement agencies of the United States, including ICE, retain the right explicitly to go on to Native American reservations, to go on to tribal land and arrest non-tribal citizens. And in cases where a non-tribal citizen commits a crime against another non-tribal citizen or against the government, as would be the arguable case for undocumented immigrants, then the jurisdiction remains in the United States and not with the tribal courts, because tribal courts have specific statutory jurisdiction, and it's complicated, the full interrelation. But the way you can think about it is the tribal courts in general have jurisdiction only over disputes between a member of the tribe and another member of the tribe. Mm. So sovereign Indian nations do not have the right. You might be asking, what about casinos? And the answer is that casinos and other quasi-governmental organizations and governmental organizations have sovereign immunity, right? And we've talked about that doctrine, right? We've talked about that with research universities, for example, being an arm of the state and having a form of sovereign immunity. So they have sovereign immunity from lawsuits that is abrogated by certain other statutes, but having sovereign immunity does not extend in the same way as having a nation that can grant citizenship to a whole bunch of folks and immunize them from prosecution from being subject to U.S. laws. So this would work better if you want to pick a tiny nation, or you want to pick a large nation like Canada and convince them to change their immigration laws to, you know, sort of automatically nationalize it. But it's not going to work on Indian reservations. Sorry. It's a great thought, and our hearts in the right place, but it's not.
Well, it was worth a shot. Oh, well.
Yep.
Well, that's too bad, but well, that's what we do here. You know, you clear up the misconceptions and, you know, make sure we're not getting too carried away with our own fake news. All right. Well, it is time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Of course, as we speak, the latest Lot Awful movies and the latest Q&A are up, so it's a great reason to pledge. And new pledges this week include Brad B., Andrew E. Janicek, Ray Suzuki, Can Atheist. Can Atheist. Oh, I like that. That's a very positive sounding one. Thank you for the new pledges. We really appreciate it. Hope you're enjoying the content.
Yeah, and thank you to Max Schmorhan, to Nick, to Regan Klein, and thank you to Grant Mangum. Let me try that again. And thank you to Grant Mangum. Thanks to all of you for your new pledges and for supporting the show. We say it every week, but we couldn't do the show without this. So if you would like to join the ranks of these people, get your shout out, get the Lot Awful movies, get bonus Q&A, get early access to Thomas Takes the Bar Exam answers, early shows, all sorts of fantastic stuff. Ask one of our patrons. They don't regret supporting the show, and you should too. Go head on over patreon.com/law, sign up and join the Cool Kids Club.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, and now it is time for me to get the bar question wrong. I hope I wasn't too embarrassingly wrong this time, but we'll see. Andrew, all right, lay it on me.
All right, so this was Dungeons and Dragons. This was the rubber match of our three questions, this was going to either put you over the top and have you a certified lawful neutral, or was going to condemn you to the ranks of.
I really took a risk on this one. We'll see. I may not be. So, you may not be finding me practicing any Dungeons and Dragons law anytime soon.
So everybody knows the setup by now. This is the last question. Ogre shoots the arrow intending to scare Mary and John, but lightning strikes near him, and so he narrowly misses Mary and hits John instead. And the question is, can Mary recover against Ogre for assault? And Thomas, you walked through what you believed you had remembered from a law class on the difference between assault and battery. And I have to tell you, your memory is exactly correct.
Oh, okay.
The reason assault and battery are lumped together is because
they pretty much always happen together.
Right. Because battery is defined as an offensive touching. So you are absolutely correct that in order to batter someone, you must actually physically touch them. In order to assault someone, you have to have the threat of bodily harm combined with a present apparent ability to cause that harm.
Okay. So this could be, could have gotten this one. We'll see.
Exactly right on the analysis. All right. So, and the thing that they test, this is going to be a hint for future bar exam questions. When they test assault and battery on the bar, they always come up with fact patterns that are designed to ask, is there a battery when there's no touching? Is there an assault when there's no touching? Right? Like that's, and so the primary thing to remember is battery equals touching, right. Assault equals No touching.
No touching. No touching. No touching.
And look, the assault can involve, I don't mean to suggest when you touch, it's no longer an assault, but it, that is an area where the common parlance of the term has outpaced.
Right.
The legal definition.
Common, like just in the world, no one thinks of assault as not touching. Like pretty much everybody is like, oh yeah, I was assaulted. He, you know, put his hands on me.
Right. So you eliminated A and B. Those were both good eliminations.
Right.
So no, she was not touched by the arrow. Obviously, we
so
just
I
that.
Am licensed to practice second chance Dungeons and Dragons law so far.
And B was no because Ogre believed she was a trespasser. Neither of those are correct. So yes, she is going to recover against Ogre for assault. And your choices were either C, yes, because Ogre used excessive force. Or D, yes, since Mary must have seen the arrow pass in front of her. And given the common law definition that I just recited to you of assault, hopefully that gives you the confidence to know that you are indeed correct.
Oh my gosh.
That you got it right. The key element there, right? We know that that she was frightened. So we know that there was an it was stipulated in the facts that Ogre intended to frighten them. So we know that there was the threat element, and then there has to be an apparent present capacity to inflict that harm. While the arrow whooshing right by you is certainly sufficient to meet that criteria. So the fact that it whooshed by her is indeed the key fact there.
I have to say, I never would have gotten this right if I didn't have that one memory from my law class. Like, I think this was a really difficult one. Like, if you knew nothing about the law and you're just a dude on a podcast trying to answer this, I think this was a really difficult question. And I
like how you want to give credit for getting that. Not to your gracious co-host who has walked you through 61 TTTB. No, definitely some anonymous university professor teaching
it's only because that predates this podcast by 15 years or whatever, 13 years. If it didn't, then certainly. Yeah, no. You know, if you weren't also in my business law class in 2008, then you know, you might have had to rely on this fantastic podcast.
Also, assault is kind of a weird tort to be teaching in business law, right?
Like,
it's not something that comes up often for me.
I guess it was so introductory enough course that it wanted to talk about like common. I don't know. I was thinking that too when I was remembering it. I was like, why were we talking about that? But it was a really excellent course. I like it a lot. Maybe it's the reason, you know, in our origin story, maybe it's the reason this podcast was in our destiny. But I would love for a little more explanation. Now, I somehow got the right answer, but C was a very attractive distractor. I had reasoned that it was because the excessive force kind of applied more to John, but I'm not confident in that reasoning. So what's the reasoning why C is not right?
So again, your professor must be amazing, but
no, this was me. I'm gonna give me credit for this one, and that means giving you credit as well, because I've learned all the bulk of my law from you.
The bulk of it. Okay. No, that's exactly right. The C is the attractive distractor, and what makes it attractive is the concept of excessive force is the analysis that comes into play when you are ejecting the trespassers from your land. But as we know here, that they're sort of two nested issues. Number one, they're not trespassers because they've got the privilege to be on the land. And number two, the liability here comes from his intent to frighten them, not his intent to eject them from the property. So it doesn't, in other words, it doesn't matter how much for, there's not an appropriate level of arrow shooting nearby that you can do to somebody who has a privilege to be in that spot, right? So in other words, remember that because of the storm, they're not trespassers. So this is the equivalent of Ogre going into the park, right?
Yeah.
And starting to fire arrows at people in the park, right? They have a right to be there. And there's no amount of inherent, like, oh, well, you know, if he'd only, you know, shot blowgun darts at them.
Oh, I
then,
see.
You know,
okay. Yeah, that probably seems obvious to you because you're a legal genius, but that took me a second to grasp. So it's, the excessive is the key there. It's like, no, that doesn't quite make sense. It's not the best answer because there is no acceptable amount of force It's just that, you know, because she saw the arrow, that's enough.
Because she saw the arrow. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That
and,
makes sense.
And I love, this is now the second question in a row where the kind of goofball sounding answer, you know, turns out to be correct. And again, that is a very common occurrence. At least it was when I took the bar back in the Stone Age. So, so I'm glad to see you,
boy,
get,
I can't
get there
believe
where,
it.
You,
wow.
where you say.
The stars yeah. aligned for this one in my brain somehow. I don't, I really am surprised
well,
I got this right.
I'm not. I'm proud of you.
Well, very nice of you to say. I will try to live up to your confidence in me. But the most important thing here is not me. Well, it is. But the second most important thing here is, Andrew, hop in your time machine and tell us, future Andrew, who is this week's winner?
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, as it turns out, a lot of the responses were split pretty evenly between C and D this week. I think my favorite came from the Rockin' Donkey. Great name. And he says very simply, TTTB, I agree with Thomas's choice D because I agree with his analysis of assault. You got it exactly right. Your analysis was exactly right. And you and the Rockin' Donkey are pals. So everyone, give the Rockin' Donkey a follow. That's at The Rockin' Noji, R-O-C-K-I-N-D-O-N-K-E-Y, at The Rockin' Donkey, a follow on Twitter. And congratulations for being this week's TTTB winner.
well, that's our show today. Thank you so much. A special thanks to Britt Hermes. Very fascinating interview. I really am curious to keep an eye on that situation. It sounds like it should be pretty soon, but you know, we'll keep an eye on it. We'll see how much faster the German courts are than ours. And of course, thank you most of all to our patrons for supporting the show and to Andrew for breaking down the law week in, week out. And we will see you for a Rapid Response Friday.
Absolutely.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.
How much clearer can I say? There's always money in the banana stand!
No touching!
No touching!
No touching!
No touching!
No touching!
No touching!